Herzl was really the biggest figure of the Zionist movement. I mean, his name is the one that most people know. They may not know that much about him, but he's the big name. Nordau, very few people know. He was really a creature of the mid to late 19th century, a societal critic and all that. Tonight, we're going to meet somebody that even fewer people know about, but in his time and in his era, had a tremendous impact on the Zionist world, even though he officially wasn't a part of it. His name is Echad HaAm. Have any of you ever heard of Echad HaAm? I didn't know too much about him until I started studying this stuff as well. We're going to talk more about him. But first, before I do that, because, you know, this class isn't necessarily linear, I want to jump in because we're trying to stay somewhat historical in terms of progression. I want to talk about the Jewish National Fund. The Jewish National Fund didn't start in the Second Aliyah, which we're going to talk about in 2 weeks. It started just before that, and actually it was Herzl who talked about that. Then we're going to talk about Cultural Zionism and Echad HaAm. And if we get a chance toward the end of the class, we're going to talk about some other ideologies that were prevalent in the Jewish world and that Zionism was fighting with. Because Zionism didn't just pop up and everybody embrace it. There were other things that were popping up that others embraced, and there were great clashes. There was great rivalries within the Jewish world. We don't have it to that extent today, but again, as I said in one of the previous classes, when you're talking about a world without the internet and without cell phones, when people are reading newspapers, and as many of you know, newspapers of that era weren't just this unbiased type of thing, right? Newspapers basically...
Like today.
Yeah, right. Well, they're definitely less biased today than they were then, without question. I mean, the Zionist movement had its own daily newspaper. I mean, what do you think basically every editorial in there was meant to say? And we know about, of course, how the Spanish-American War was started by muckraking journalism and so on. We don't have it to that extent today. We obviously have a Washington Times and a Washington Post, which come from very different perspectives on the same exact thing, but it's still not to the impact that it was then. All right, story of the Jewish National Fund. Let me get this back here so you can see this in the background. Where are we? There we go. This one responds a little more quickly. It was the 5th Zionist Congress in Basel in 1901, and Theodor Herzl was furious. This was the third time that the Zionist Congress was debating whether or not to create a Jewish National Fund. Don't think of the Jewish National Fund, the JNF, as we think of it as today, as trees, you know, even though it's a lot more complex than that today. This was something that was needed as a vehicle to collect money for the Zionist movement. It was legal. It was also, again, meant to give an address and what have you. Herzl came out. He heard that it wasn't going that well, that people were debating as to whether or not they really needed a Jewish National Fund. Should they put their efforts elsewhere? Should it be in what was cultural Zionism? Should it be in political Zionism? Should it be in the emerging practical Zionism? He came out and gave a very impassioned speech. And they finally voted on this matter, and they voted to create a Jewish National Fund. 1 month later, a man named Yona Krumenetsky was dispatched to Jaffa, right? There is no Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv pops up and doesn't pop up. It's created in 1909. It really starts being settled in 1911, 1912, but they decide to create it in 1909. So he's dispatched to Jaffa to open the Jewish National Fund office of the Zionist organization. The goal was, anybody know?
Buy land.
Exactly, to buy land. That was the raison d'etre of the Jewish National Fund, to buy land. And buying land was no simple matter. We talked about it a little bit in a previous class. When you bought land, you usually bought it, not usually, but often bought it from an absentee landowner, and you were going to kick off the Arabs who had maybe for certainly generations, if not centuries, had been farming that land, and they weren't aware of this. Or they had been paying a pittance to this landowner, and it did not create goodwill. This was very delicate business. Also, it had to be done in a certain way so that it didn't help drive up the price of land for land speculators. Right? There were some Arabs who would start colluding and basically say, we're not only going to sell land if it's at this price. So Yona Krumenetsky had to do it somewhat on the low, and it wasn't necessarily that easy to do. So the goal was to purchase land, but it really did something else that it continues to do until this day. It gave a connection to the Jews of the diaspora, to literally the land of Israel. It was no longer a mythical thing. They could donate to something that was going to buy land for the Jewish renaissance. And this was really another first that came under Herzl's watch. Herzl really started everything in this regard. He also began, Kremenetsky, issuing stamps. And here's a picture of one of the early stamps. It just says Keren Kayemet Lisrael, which is Jewish National Fund. And this says Gan Shmuel, which is the name of a place in Israel. These stamps were the stamps that the Jewish community in Palestine used, and Jewish collectors around the world started purchasing them as well. They were used as the stamps of the new state of Israel in 1948 until they could get the original stamps going. If you want to have some fun, as I did, go on the internet and type in Jewish National Fund stamps or JNF stamps, and you'll see collages and collections, and there's really a lot of neat stuff there. And we're going to get to the blue box. Anybody know what that's called in Yiddish? Pushki, that's right. I didn't even know it had an English name when I was growing up. And I still don't think it has an English name. All right, where were we? So, Kremenetsky then took the idea of a Galician bank clerk. Right? People would write people, I have this idea for you, this is what you should do. It was to put out these little collection boxes. Well, this became a fantastic hit. I have one sitting by my door today. I don't use it enough, but it's there, and I would guess that nearly every home that has a kid that went to Hebrew school has a pushki. When I was a kid, by the way, every time I had a test, my mother would put a nickel in the pushki to say, for good luck. You know, didn't work, actually. Maybe she should have put a dime in. I don't know. It usually didn't work that well. But it's an example of how the concept was grafted onto my consciousness. I didn't question it. It was going to Israel. Okay, it's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing. I love the design on this, too, though. You know, the desert, palm trees, and all that. Again, at the bottom, Keren Kayemet Lisrael, Jewish National Fund. Between the wars, between World War I and World War II, there were more than 1 million pushkis in Jewish homes around the world. Keep in mind, there were anywhere from 12 to 14 million Jews in the world at that time today, just as there's only 14 million today. They quickly became iconic in the Jewish world, and it was another way in which Zionism worked its way into the homes of, it seemed like, everybody. Kremenetsky wasn't done, of course. His main job was to buy land. So he kept buying land. First, in the spring of 1903, remember he had started in 1901, he bought 50 acres in what is today Hedera, and it became an olive grove. He had some of the settlers and the land at that point go there and plant and take care of an olive grove. You know, olive groves are fascinating. Does anybody know when an olive tree finally gives olives? It's about 100 years. And there's a nice story from the Middle East of an Arab guy who was planting an olive tree, and somebody says to him, why are you planting that olive tree? You'll never see the fruits of your labors. And he says, it's for my grandchildren. And in some ways, that's the way the Middle East thinks. You know, not in the day-to-day quick pace that we think of today. If anyone's ever tried to get anything done in Israel in a bank or a post office, you know exactly what I'm saying. All right, in 1909, he helped buy land for what was going to be Tel Aviv. And we're going to talk more about Tel Aviv when we deal with the Second Aliyah, because that was one of the many products of the Second Aliyah. He also began the Olive Tree Fund for diaspora support. That was the first tree campaign. Right? And even today, every synagogue in Baltimore, by the way, bar and bat mitzvah, every modern Orthodox conservative and Reform synagogue, every bar and bat mitzvah kid gets a certificate that says, you know, it's a fund that Leonard Atman put together. This has been planted in your honor in Israel. You know, again, it's iconic. It's not just iconic, it's normative. Listen to this. By 1935, 1.7 million trees have been planted. That's a lot of trees. And remember, this is a country that's a desert. You know, sometimes when you drive around Israel today, you still see a little bit of that outside, you know, particularly when you're going further south you go, you see it. But that's what the whole country looked like at that point. By 1921, he had purchased 25,000 acres. Only 2 years later, he was at 50,000 acres. Now, again, we're going to get to this too, but that's also a time when there's a wave of immigration coming from Europe, because that's the high point of the British Mandate era, when things were good. By 1935, they had almost 90,000 acres. So they went from 25,000 in 21 to almost 90,000 in 35. And those 90,000 acres, they had housing for 109 Jewish communities. By 1948, the Jewish National Fund owned 54% of the land that Jews owned. Now, the Jewish National Fund owning land was and is controversial. They wouldn't sell it. They said that they were the caretakers of the land for the people of Israel. Even, I think it was a year or two ago, there was a big controversy because some community somewhere, I think it was in the Galilee, on land that was owned by the Jewish National Fund, wouldn't let an Arab move into that community. I don't know if any of you remember that. Eventually, the Arab was allowed to be let in, but it wasn't in the rules because the rules said this is land for the Jewish people. And that's what happens when you have an entity, a quasi-private entity, I guess, owning the land. So it remains very controversial today. Most land in Israel is not owned by the people who live on that land. It's owned by the government through the Israel Lands Authority or the Jewish National Fund. It's a little convoluted system. Did you want to say something, Mitch?
Just that real estate in Israel is not like it is in the United States.
Yes.
Very different.
Yeah.
And they own their homes to the ground leases.
Yeah, they own their homes.
Leases.
Yeah.
They do a lot of ground leases.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a version of ground rent.
Right.
Which we still have in Baltimore.
Against them. So if you've got a piece of property, you can sell it, whether there's a lien against it back here, you can sell it to somebody else. And they never check for liens until somebody finally says, who owns this property? And you find out there's a lien here and there's a lien there.
Right.
And it may be 20 people.
It's a crazy system.
Uh-huh.
And but it's a crazy system. And by the way, it was just as crazy during the time of the Ottoman Turks when you were trying to buy land from an absentee landowner who may have sold a portion of it to someone else and not told anybody else and what have you. And it only leads to confusion.
It's not like you can go down to City Hall and check the records.
Correct.
Under the Ottomans.
Yeah. Oh, not at all. Not at all. The Ottoman system, remember they were called, the Ottoman Empire was the sick man of Europe. It was the sick man of Europe for about 100 years. So it was falling apart. It was getting very good at falling apart. It would take a world war to finally end it. Actually, it didn't technically end until 1922. The Young Turks overthrew the Sultan, and again, that was their third revolution. All right, one final note on the Jewish National Fund. A few years later, after being in Israel, Kremenetsky bought land around what's known as Hulda today, Hulda. It's a well-known suburban community, and it's in central Israel. And he started a forest in memory of Theodor Herzl. This is very nice. The first forest in Israel was in memory of Theodor Herzl. So we can appreciate that. And that's a bit of the story of the Jewish National Fund. I did some extra looking around, by the way. Their website has a nice history if you want to go and look at what it does until this current day. They have a very nice website. But there's a lot of stuff in history books about them, too. Oh, here's, by the way, there you go, 100 years of blue boxes from around the world. And where's the one we just saw? Right here. And this is the one that I have in my house now. That's the more modern one. It doesn't come out as well, unfortunately, on this. But there's some nice collections out there. Here's another stamp. Let's test you out. Anybody read that for me? Excellent. Bezalel is an art academy that's still in Jerusalem. It's very famous. Again, another product of the Second Aliyah, which we're going to get to. And this was their original building, the castle, as it was known. And again, Keren Kayemet L'Yisrael up on top. All right, so we are going to get to these questions in a little bit, right? Right. I decided the last minute yesterday to change my notes around, so I'm not always clear on where they're at. So bear with me. I think it flows a little better. We're going to move now to cultural Zionists. Remember, 2 weeks ago, I put on the board political Zionists, practical Zionists, cultural Zionists, religious Zionists. I think that was it. Yeah. Practical, political, cultural,
synthetic.
Religious, synthetic Zionists. Thank you. That's because Chaim Weizmann, by the way, started out as a cultural, and then he became a practical, and then he became a synthetic. So you can kind of trace the Zionist movement through him. We're going to do a whole session next week on Chaim Weizmann, who, next to Herzl, was, the sub-giant, I guess. Who had a career, obviously, that ended as the president of the newly found state of Israel. Cultural Zionism didn't win the day. It wasn't as powerful as political Zionism or practical Zionism, but it shaped the argument. It really did. It's hard to imagine what the Zionist movement would have been without cultural Zionism, because it wouldn't have linked itself as well to the Eastern European Jews, who were the backbone, right? The Western Jews were the founders, the Eastern European Jews were the foot soldiers of the movement. And if anything, cultural Zionism was a product of Eastern Europe. So it forced the conversation about what Zionism was supposed to be. Many of the cultural Zionists themselves, by the way, grew up religious. And I don't mean anything other than hardcore, what we would call Haredi Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox today, going to yeshivas, and then they secretly, like many in their generation did, started reading Haskalah material, Enlightenment material, which we talked about way back, it seems like, and they started getting different ideas, and they said, hey, I just can't live this way. But they were a little different than some others. They could get rid of religion, but they couldn't get rid of Jewishness. What Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, would later call in America Jewish peoplehood. That was who they were. They weren't trying to run away from that. Herzl, actually it's not fair to say Herzl ran away from his religion. He never really had it, although he had a little more in his youth than he had when he was an adult. They clearly rejected religious authority. They weren't interested in that at all. They were interested in enlightenment, philosophy, secular knowledge, while maintaining their Jewishness. So they too, just like Herzl in many regards, were trying to create a new sense of Judaism and being part of the Jewish people. And that's really what's going on in this era, right? We have all these movements. Remember when we go back to our friend Mr. Hobsbawm? I know you guys have gone back and reread that book, right? Did you watch the movie? No, just kidding. Hobsbawm talked about all these various movements that were coming up. Well, the Jewish people were large and not necessarily scattered, but they were different, and all these movements, different types of Judaism, or different approaches, I should say, to Judaism, were coming up as well. Many of these folks, by this point in their lives, were atheists and agnostics. Of course, they were atheists and agnostics who could, as they say, cite you chapter and verse of what was going on. These were well-educated people in what we call religiously as well as secularly. Many of them grew up in small towns, which where the religion was always the strongest. What do we call those small towns? Shtetls, Shtetlachen, the shtetls of Eastern Europe. They all moved to big cities. Many of them gravitated toward places like Odessa. Many of them did go west. They went to places like Berlin and Vienna. And particularly the college students, Chaim Weizmann wound up being one of these. A lot of Eastern European young Jews, particularly the men, wound up in the colleges of Central Europe, the German-speaking lands in particular. That was really the prize for them, to get into those universities. The cultural Jews, as I said, were from the East, and the other Jews, the political Zionists, were from the West. This was the Jewish equivalent of a clash of cultures, what we're about to describe. Excuse me. The cultural Zionists weren't interested in the problem of Jews. By that, what I mean is that the political Zionists were concerned with anti-Semitism, what was happening to Jews. The cultural Zionists were upset with what was happening to Judaism. They saw rampant assimilation. They saw people rejecting religion for nothing, right? Which you could say is something that's happened in this country today. A lot of synagogues and agencies are trying to fight that. So these questions aren't necessarily new ones in the Jewish community. They don't see a mass immigration to Palestine as happening anytime soon. They don't see a charter coming anytime soon. And in fact, they say that the Jewish people are wholly unprepared for that. What we need to do is build up slowly the community in the land of Israel, and from there, they're going to impact what we do, because we're going to have a connection to them, they're going to rejuvenate Hebrew, they're going to create new ways of observing Jewish life. And by the way, that ultimately is what happened. Have any of you ever been on a kibbutz for a Jewish holiday? No one? Yeah? Which one?
Kfar HaNasi.
And what holiday?
I was there for, the fall Yom Kippur, mm-hmm. which most of them didn't keep. Sukkot.
What did they do for Sukkot? That's a great example.
They actually didn't do anything on the kibbutz. It was
very secular.
Okay. It was a pretty secular
kibbutz.
Because
it's an agricultural holiday. Which,
but they were really happy about Tu B'Shvat.
They're happy. In what way were they happy about Tu B'Shvat?
I mean, that was like their big thing because they were agricultural. So they had, that's when they got excited. And they didn't really do a whole lot for that either.
Okay.
But they were at least excited for that holiday.
You said you were on a kibbutz for Jewish holiday? Which?
Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Okay, and what did they do there?
I think I was there long enough, I think it was Passover as well.
Okay. So,
and everything in between. Right?
Did they do anything unusual for those things? Is it something that struck you as unusual?
To be honest with you, it's been over 30 years.
Yeah. That's nothing.
I mean, it was probably another day to party, quite frankly.
Well,
there was definitely cake.
Yeah.
So I spent 3 months on what's Kfar Mazarin, which is north of Akko.
Oh, okay.
And we were out in the fields on Tisha B'Av. And I said, shouldn't we get off today? And the kibbutznik, who was kind of our leader, he says, that's for Jews. We're Israelis.
Ah.
Wow.
I had a similar situation once in Israel. A woman on a kibbutz told me she felt Israeli, not Jewish. And I was like, what? You know? It, very different to our diaspora ears. But the point is that on kibbutzim until today, particularly the three pilgrimage festivals, which have an agricultural basis, many kibbutzim, not all kibbutzim, there are some kibbutzim which are ostensibly communist, but radically secular, or what have you. Many kibbutzim do unusually creative, different types of things. They'll have parades, they'll put on plays, they'll march, they'll sing their certain songs. Remember how we saw with the poem about Masada from Yitzhak Lamdan? He changed some verses from the Psalms. They would do those types of things. They would mesh it to meet their modern sensibilities. That's cultural Zionism. Finding a way to make it work for your life, not rejecting the fact that you're Jewish, reinterpreting the fact that you're Jewish, which is obviously very controversial. But I would submit that as American or diaspora Jews, we all do that all the time. But that's another conversation. You're shaking your head, Mitch.
I agree.
we all do that all the time. All right. So what they really did, the bottom line is, they were looking to create a yeshuv or a settlement in Palestine that was going to reinvigorate the concept of Jewish life and living and be the shining example. And they literally, Echad HaAm, who we'll get to in a moment, literally said that that community was going to be the center of the wheel, and the spokes were going to come out to the diaspora, the center of the spoke wheel. So, take a few minutes, and we're going to debate the dilemmas that these guys debated. I guess, you know what, let's do this instead of doing it separately and breaking into little groups or whatever. Let's take it one by one. What is Jewish culture? We talk about Jewish culture all the time. What'd it be? Yeah?
Tradition.
What does that mean?
Well, doing the things that I guess Jewish people have done for so many years that have identified you as being Jewish.
So give me an example. And if I caught you off guard, don't worry about it.
No, that's okay. I'm just trying to think about something that wouldn't be too religiously focused, you know, like synagogue or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But lighting candles, is that more traditional?
There too, I don't know if that gets...
All right, we're going to come back to that, because that's a great example. Anything else you want to add?
I really can't make
anything. Okay, Michelle? What?
Shabbat dinner
is a cultural experience. Did you say prayer? Is it your Shabbat dinner?
I guess some people.
What's that
do
from?
And some people don't.
It's from the Torah. Yeah.
Not everybody does.
It's true. It's true. When I was on kibbutz, I'll get you in a second. I was on kibbutz Chanita in which is way north. It's next to the closest villages in Lebanon. It's called Arma, next to Rosh HaNikra. It was in the mountain across, next to that. On Friday night, they didn't light candles and they didn't do kiddush or anything like that. They sang songs. They sang secular songs that were fun songs, and I still remember some of them. That was Shabbat to them. That was Jewish culture to me. Yeah.
Well, dancing the Hora.
Excellent, dancing the Hora.
A lot of what we do at weddings, I think, is more Jewish tradition. But I want to say something else, and that is, that question as it pertains to the late 1800s is a very different question than as it pertains to what we view.
Talk
as,
a little bit about that.
Because what I got from reading Ahad Ha'am's pleadings or his, you know, work is that because of Haskalah and this enlightenment and this suddenly thinking about what does it mean to be a man versus what it is to immerse yourself in all the study where you're almost like a cog in a machine of transmuting this whole picture of life from generation to generation, I felt like this yearning of the spirit and the soul, like I want to live, I want to look at grass, I want to look at a tree and not be told that I deserve death and I'm a failure because it's not all about studying the Torah. So in that time, I would say that the awakening to the secular world, you couldn't separate what you did as a Jew from how you lived your life until you started looking at the secular world and almost like, well, what was I going to keep and what was I going to shrug off as I made my way as a human being?
Right, and keep in mind, you're absolutely right, and keep in mind that Western Jews had a very different relationship to this than Eastern Jews.
And that's why I loved reading what he wrote, because to me, he was the first person who was informed about what was going on in the West well enough to understand the contrast to what was going on in
right.
the East.
Right, he was a very bright man.
And he could hold them both at the same time in his hands and examine them and see, you know, kind of like where his own thoughts panned out on this. But I felt he had a very astute understanding of Herzl's Zionism.
Oh, which he hated.
Yeah.
Which he despised. We'll get to that.
Because of his thoughts about all of that,
right.
You know, assimilation.
Right. He thought Herzl was a joke, basically. All right. Anything else on cultural Judaism?
On Sukkot, inviting people to your sukkah for meals has been a traditional.
Absolutely. That's absolutely one of the traditions.
Now,
of course, people today would say that if you put up a sukkah, you're religious. Today. Now, we go back to a different era, and maybe not as much so. Maybe not as much so. But clearly there's biblical commandments to do that as well. Which brings us to some of our next questions, which get a little more difficult. And again, these are the questions that were debated by cultural Zionists. Does Jewish culture invariably spring from Jewish religion?
I vote yes.
Why?
If you look at it, how it's evolved through the decades of the last 120 years or whatever, from people who, like Ahad Ha'am, who started to feel a separation and move away from it, but still connect to being Jewish, I think it all comes from the Jewish education. Like you said, all of these kids were Heder kids, and they were very, very well versed in their traditions.
Yeah, this first generation was.
And so I would say that they would say what they liked best, probably, and or maybe what was good for keeping the family together, even if they were going to shed some of the stricter elements of it.
Right, and in some regards, because of, as you said earlier, this is what we do because we're Jews. We don't necessarily attach religious significance to it, although there is religious reasoning behind it. So, you know, there almost everything there's religious reasoning. One difference is what the cultural Zionists were trying to create, which was a Hebrew culture. And they talked over and over again about the Hebrew culture. Let me get Mitch and then Michelle.
I think history would predates religion. Like, you know, Moses, we had Moses, that's the history.
Right.
Then you have Passover, that's a religious tribute to history. And then it goes from history to religion and then to culture, which is basically where we are now.
Okay. It's good. And I like how you phrase Passover is a religious tribute to history.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting phrase. I hadn't heard it like that. I'm going to mull that over.
Okay.
I like that. Yeah.
So I was actually thinking it was a yes and a no. If you include the Jewish music and foods as part of Jewish culture, you and then you have to take a look at the whole world's Jewry, you see that we've absorbed most of it from wherever we ended up.
Right.
On the other hand, just about every one of those different communities has a cholent.
Right, a chamim in this.
Because they needed something, right, because they needed something to
Chalt is
have
the food on Shabbat that Ashkenazi Jews eat.
But they have it, in, like, but they have a similar thing in the Sephardi communities and the Iranian. It's just different flavors, but it's all the same kind of potted thing that you can leave overnight and eat the next day.
So you're saying that's Jewish culture?
I'm saying that's Jewish culture, but that part springs from religion, whereas
right.
the other stuff we call, you know, that we call Jewish culture parts of food and music are bits that we've absorbed from every little place that we go, which is why Hatikvah is a Hungarian folk song.
Well, and and music, by the way, is one of the things that was on my list to talk about. The modern world, ostensibly, gave us a plethora of music. We had composers. I don't know when the first composer was, certainly the 1700s. Anybody know when the first composers were? No, just composers, music, when music, I mean, we've had chamber music. 1600s, okay.
Well, it goes back to Greece.
But in the modern era, we had an explosion of music. And we certainly, all you have to do is walk into any Jewish bookstore in town or anywhere in the world, and you see baby, you know, CDs or whatever that aren't particularly religious, but we would all say they're inherently Jewish. So, let's see, who else? Mitch, you wanted to say something?
No.
Yeah, are you sure?
It depends on what you classify. When you say composer, that's different from a songwriter.
Yes. So I'm really saying songwriter. You're correct, David. You're correct. So, thank you.
Well, klezmer.
Klezmer? Yeah, klezmer is certainly from Eastern Europe around this era. Yeah.
But they're using it in temples.
I think
that
the once super religious Jews veered from the path, and they started to relate to the culture at large and become more pragmatic, and information started to flow, and more people could have access to information. So many of the cultural traditions really have changed over time. I mean, the Sunday school that I went to when I was a kid is very different from the Sunday school and the Jewish preschool.
Yeah, it's only 2 days now.
There was no Jewish preschool when I was a kid where
right.
I lived. But my children went to Jewish preschool.
Well, that's a great example. Jewish preschool. You know, is that a religious thing or is it just a cultural thing?
It's a way to transmit religious ideas. So.
Absolutely.
The definition of religion. The definition of religion at this time was probably much different and narrower than we see religion today.
In the East it was, but not in the West, where we had conservative reform and neo-orthodoxy or modern orthodoxy.
I don't mean so much that. I mean, what is religion? What does it do? I mean, it's a certain relationship to a structure of prayer and ritual, and we would now blur that, and we see religious activity and all kinds of things that people wouldn't, back then, would seem foreign to what was religion.
Right.
All a part of breaking out from the mold of interaction with the world and trying to how you correlate that to being Jewish or who you are or express your behavior through something that reflects your own experiences and preferences.
Good. You guys hit on all the same themes, all the right themes. Just so you know, my personal view is that it's in the eye of the beholder. To me, basically everything in Jewish life has a religious base, which sometimes I like and sometimes I dislike. But the people who are doing those things don't necessarily see that or feel that. So for them, it's simply not religious. It's you know, some people might construct a sukkah because that's a cool thing to do to remember what happened in the desert. It's paying tribute to a historical event. Other people do it because it says in the Torah you should erect a hut.
I think people who are religious, they would say it's a way of living.
Absolutely, comprehensive.
Whereas people who are less religious oftentimes, I think, attribute some of religious values to a humanistic point of view, and you live your life by certain rules and regulations as opposed to religion tells you exactly how to live, what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, religion answers all the questions in your life, down to the time of day and you name it. I don't want to veer off too much, but if you, my mom needs wrote a whole
how
book.
How you live day by day, and what you say when you wake up, and what you say when you eat, And when you...
I'll just say that there's a wealth of material in Jewish philosophy that struggles with this, including Maimonides, The Guide for the Perplexed, which is a very difficult book to read.
Yeah, as an aside, I think the purpose of religion, and my parents are still alive, I've never lost anybody, but I feel like the purpose of religion is to explain death.
Okay. You're all good cultural Zionists, I'll have you know. You know, in the modern world, I think we all are, even when we don't know it. Yeah.
I have a question. If you don't believe in God, is any of it really religious activity? Is it all really cultural activities?
That's a great question. I don't know if I want to start that conversation.
I think religious atheists, there are religious atheists. There's just recently an article in the Jewish Times about
right.
Jewish religious atheists. They would say they are religious, many of them, because to them, God is not necessarily part of their religious practice. That's just
spiritual.
They're comforted by community.
They say religious.
Yeah, they're comforted by community and ritual.
Yeah.
Right, you don't need to be religious to enjoy ritual.
And
again, it's in the eye of the beholder. It's in the eye of the beholder. And you know, it doesn't help when you argue with someone and say, no, you're actually being religious. Right? Because they say, no, I'm not. It's in the eye of the beholder. We all view the world in our own way. We've been trained and raised and made choices.
But Israelis would say, we don't need to be religious. We live in the land. Mm-hmm. And that's enough.
Absolutely, and that's why you get some Israelis that say, I'm Israeli, I'm not Jewish. They are the direct products of what Echad Ha'am and his followers were trying to create, which was a Hebrew culture. They speak Hebrew, they do everything Hebrew. And by the way, the greatest of the secular writers in Israel, until this very day in fiction, use biblical allusions throughout their works, right? Because they learn that stuff growing up in secular public school, right? They study the Bible as literature. They study it as an historical document. That's, you know, what Israel is today for non-religious Jews is what the cultural Zionists were trying to create. And by the end of his life, I'm skipping a little bit, Echad Ha'am finally stopped being, you know, the sour man of the Zionist movement and actually moved to Tel Aviv and lived there from 1922 to 27 and served on the city council of Tel Aviv and did some writing. And when he died, it was a huge national event. 30,000 people attended his funeral. I mean, he was a big, big fella. And you're getting a picture, by the way, that so many of the people in this era were giants. They were intellectual giants. They were great leaders. They were great writers. Polyglots.
All these different cultures.
Absolutely.
Why is he referred to as the agnostic rabbi?
He's referred to as the agnostic rabbi or the reluctant prophet is the other phrase that they use. Because the people who gave him that title basically said he is a man who is tormented, right? He is steeped in Jewish religious learning. And his writing has all these allusions. He quotes from the Torah all throughout his writings and Talmud and other texts. So he uses his knowledge to advance his cause, but he refuses to lead a religious life at that point. Even though, by the way, his wife is from a Hasidic family, and she stays with him all her life, and she goes along with his not being religious. So he's a philosopher more than anything else that's trying to put his philosophy into action. He's a philosopher amongst the people. Echad Ha'am means one of the people. His real name is Asher Ginsberg. But why is he? Others gave him that nickname. And I think it's accurate. He is tormented in many regards in his writing. He is not a happy person. Many of these figures, by the way, including Echad Ha'am, would be a psychiatrist's dream. Right?
Or nightmare,
right. They grew up one way, they rejected it, but they couldn't give it up, so they tried to reinterpret it, and they were displaced physically, let alone emotionally, and so on and so on and so on. But they kept on plugging ahead. These people were phenomenally productive. You know, the first week we talked about Zionism being a revolution. These are the revolutionaries, right? These people are incredible people. They're really interesting people. Any of them who strike your interest, please go find a biography of them. Go to Amazon, get a used version for $5.95 plus shipping and handling. You know, I don't get any credit for any money from it. But Echad Ha'am, there's a great biography by a guy named Zipperstein. Came out 5 years ago or something like that. Hey, did you want to say something else?
Not necessarily, except that the way I see this whole period is like two tectonic plates kind of like coming together. And all the tension that it causes, the Enlightenment versus traditional life and mm-hmm. the shtetl and all of that. And then there's this eruption of these incredible people who couldn't take the tension. They had to emerge from it. They were not
right.
going to be crushed by it. They were going to pave a new road for people to start thinking and walking on.
These people were incredibly strong. In some regards, they were all incredibly arrogant as well, because they all thought they were right. They weren't interested in compromise. They believed that they needed to influence everything that was going on. We're going to get to a guy in a little bit, Micah Berdichevsky, you know, who became Echad HaAm's nemesis. If Echad HaAm was Herzl's nemesis, Berdichevsky was Echad HaAm's nemesis, and so on. And so then we're going to get to a really radical guy named Jacob Klatskin, who basically said, "You're all worthless. You know, listen to me."
But did they all agree that they wanted to preserve Jewish identity, and the vehicle for doing that was Zionism and settling in Israel?
Yes, but they all had different versions of how that would be accomplished.
But they all wanted to call themselves Jewish at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Some of them, you know, there was actually in the 30s and 40s in Palestine a group called the Canaanites who believed that they were so original, returning to the original faith, that they weren't Hebrews, they weren't Jewish, they were Canaanites. And they looked up Canaanite ritual and all that type of stuff. We might get to them.
Like the Mormons.
Yeah, well, the Mormons is a different thing. They kind of, you know, it sounded good, so they invented it. If you ever want to read a crazy book, read the Book of Mormon. Yeah, there's some wild theories. I mean, that's basically coming from outer space. I mean, that's. Yeah, you wanted to say something?
The internal turmoil.
Yeah, I thought you did. Okay. What?
The internal turmoil of growing up one way, going someplace else, fighting that and believing it and being next. You know, and being an expounder of that whole concept, only near the very end of their lives to turn around and go to something else. I mean, what must that have done to them internally?
I mean, one can only imagine. You know, on the one hand, we have a very different culture today. We take a lot of time, we analyze who we are, and, you know, we seek professional help and do that, and I'm not disparaging that at all. We analyze things to death. They were doers. You know, and they poured it out in their writings, right? They didn't go to Starbucks and talk to somebody about it and say, "Hey, I have a good idea." They would write it up and send it to Hamalitz, you know, the Achi Asaf, the publishing group that Echad HaAm's followers created, and they would have it printed, and then it would create debate, right? They were very different in their approach. They were nonstop, relentless people. What did it do to them? I imagine it made them difficult people to be with. And apparently a lot of these people were difficult. Echad HaAm was a little different. He apparently was very shy, right? And he never officially took a position in the Zionist movement, although he certainly could have. He went to the first Zionist Congress as an observer, and he wrote that he felt that he was a mourner at a wedding banquet because there was nothing going on there, in his view, that was Jewish. He's what we would call, in lack of better terminology today, a Jewish Jew. Herzl certainly wasn't. Right, we read out the New Land, Old New Land, right? You know, the question always comes up: what's Jewish about it? And the response is, it's in the land of Israel. You know,
this was not the only movement going on. You know, you had Marx and Engels, and
Well, they were a little earlier, but their followers.
No,
right.
You had their followers who were doing the same thing.
And we right.
If you read the Russian communist history and all the fights and how everybody thought it was right, and it was only until, you know, a strong man would come along.
Right, and you had the Bundists, who were Jewish socialists, and then we're going to get to, I keep saying in a few weeks we're going to be really busy, I guess, we get to the labor Zionists, which tried to merge the socialism of the Bund and Zionism. A lot of intellectual ferment going on here, a lot of characters, it's hard to keep them all straight. It really is. I always get mixed up between Nachman Sirkin and Nachum Sirkin. You know, I was reading both of them the other day. I'm trying to. They're different people from different eras. All right, I think we have one last question. Believe it or not, we might have answered it. Let's take a quick look. Excuse me. We timed out.
What's the same password I use?
I got it from you. I have a little camera on your laptop. What for some Jews... we kind of did this. Can you have Jewish culture with religion in the background? I think we did that. What for some Jews, circa 1900, would be comforting about Jewish culture instead of religion? What would make Echad HaAm feel good about Jewish culture instead of Jewish religion? It's still ritual. It's still doing things. It's still very Jewish.
But it allows you to connect to the secular world. It doesn't reject integrating elements of the secular world into your real life.
I think you got it. Anyone else want to add to that? After I said it, you got it. I think you hit the nail on the head. What it enabled them to do was not be a traitor to their people. That was important to them. These were the Jews who couldn't run away. Not didn't want to, couldn't. It wasn't in them to run away. These weren't all the Jews. There were certainly Jews who went to Western European universities, Russian Jews, who just assimilated. We don't study them because they didn't change history.
They came to Baltimore. I mean, they left Russia and came to
Baltimore. The vast majority of Jews came to the United States, right? 2.5 million would come to the United States from 1882 to 1924. I mean, a significant amount of Jews. Actually, about more like 3 million if you go up that high. And many of them were Zionists. And Baltimore has a nice Zionist tradition as well. It really does. Baltimore, actually, I can't remember his name. Baltimore had a delegate to the Zionist Convention in 1901, I think, was the earliest. Alright, let's take a look at the man himself. Echad HaAm, unlike many of the people we've looked at, doesn't have a beard for the ages. Right? It's a nice trim beard. And I'll put this up. I'll get to the quote in a little bit. He was obviously a scholarly looking man. He was an intense man. As I said, he was relatively shy. Let's talk a little bit about, what I haven't covered yet. Let me see if we need to take a break yet. We still have 5 minutes. That's good. All right. One of the things that I wanted to point out as well is that, let me stand out of your way in case you're looking at it. One of the things I wanted to point out as well is that Jewish culture was a new thing in Eastern Europe. All right? Jewish life had been ruled primarily by religion. Well, the Enlightenment was finally seeping in. The Enlightenment and then Jewish culture obviously came into being in Western and Central Europe earlier. We have different types of Judaism, I mentioned. We have Reform starts in 1817 in Hamburg. Then we have the Neo-Orthodoxy or Modern Orthodoxy of Samson Raphael Hirsch in the last half of the 19th century. We have conservative Judaism, which is known as positive historical Judaism, for how they look at history. That comes up in the 1860s with Zachariah Frankel. We have other things going on. We have the Hebrew monthlies, which are a Jewish cultural experience. Even though some of the readers, or many of the readers, I should say, are in Eastern Europe, they're based in Vienna. They're based in Berlin and places like that. We have Jewish philanthropy already going on in the West. That's another form of Jewish culture. Right, helping your fellow Jews. We have the Rothschilds, we have Montefiore in England. We have Jewish literature, secular literature, beginning to form. Remember, Herzl writes a play called The New Ghetto, which is about how he thinks Jews aren't assimilating. That's really a secular approach to a Jewish question. And over in England, we have Disraeli, who wrote a book, I think it was called Tancred, or something like that. It had a Jewish character who talked about being a wandering Jew. Cultural Judaism was new, and thus it was also somewhat exciting. In the East, it enabled these Jews to stay affiliated with the Jewish people. Not Jewish religion, but the Jewish people. And keep in mind, this is the only generation that could really do it, because their children weren't going to be raised Jewish in the ways that we consider to be Jewish. They would be I shouldn't say Jewish, I should say religious. Yeah?
I think also there was a new kind of anti-Jewishness. Anti-Semitism that was racially based, that was from sources of nationalism, that
right.
said no matter what, you can never be part of the general populace, so you're always different, you're always an alien.
Good. And you're absolutely correct. We see in the 1880s and 1890s in Germany, Döring and Wilhelm Marr are creating anti-Semitic political parties and tractates. We see this springing up in almost every country in Europe, with the exception of England. The exception of England. England always seems to have a special place where it is not as anti-Semitic. There were concerns when Eastern Europeans were crowding into the West End of London, that it was, you know, not necessarily the desirable Jews, but it didn't get out of hand like it would in France with the Dreyfus trial, or in Germany, or in other countries. All right, here's the Chada'am. I'm going to give you some background, some biography on the Chada'am, some of which I've already given you, but I want to give it to you in one slate. And then we're going to take a break, and then come back. And Michelle, Jill, you brought cheesecakes tonight, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. I had some chocolate cake earlier, so I'm sad, but yeah. All right, the Chada'am was born in 1856. He died in 1927. That means he came of age in the late 1860s and 1870s, in terms of being a young man who was reading Haskalah literature, who was trying to gain exposure to Western ideas and ideals. This was also a time, I don't think we've really mentioned it yet, there was a tremendous increase in the population of the Jews of Eastern Europe. Jews were in squalid conditions. They were being forced into, more forced into the Pale of the Settlement. The shtetls that we know of from Fiddler on the Roof and what have you, which were much uglier and dirtier than portrayed in that movie, were thriving, if that's the right word to say, in that era. There was a relinquishment of harshness toward the Jews, and then a clamping down by after 1881, remember, in Eastern Europe. So things were very difficult and very harsh for Jews. And someone like a Chada'am, who had been exposed to all this Western literature and thought, began seeking other ideas. He was actually born to well-to-do parents who were Hasidim, you know, Hasidic Jews. He had that type of an upbringing. At age 8, he started secretly teaching himself the Haskalah, or reading the Haskalah literature. Age 8, he was obviously a bit of a prodigy. He went to a cheder, or a traditional Jewish school, until the age of 12. Next year, obviously, he has his bar mitzvah. He gets married. Around 20, he becomes the minister of a large estate in Kiev. That was a job that you did in those days. I mentioned to you early, he married a woman who was also from a Hasidic family. He became critical of Orthodoxy's dogmatic nature. He starts to write. By the early 30s, his early 30s, it's the 1880s, he moves to Odessa. Anybody remember what Odessa's like? That's the place. That's where it's happening.
Hotbed of thought.
That's the Wild West of Jewish ideology, right? There's Chovei Tzion. You remember we talked about them. The Chovei Tzion movement is really centered there. Leon Pinsker is there. He's the guy that wrote Auto-Emancipatio, or Self-Emancipation. A Chada'am likes this philosophy, and he gets very involved in Chovei Tzion. And in fact, he's going to wind up going to Israel eventually. We're going to see after break, to check on Chovei Tzion colonies there. Because Chovei Tzion and the Bilu, which we also talked about, were the only ones in that era who were sending people to the land of Israel to live. Remember, by 1900, there were only 25,000 Jews in the land of Israel, and there were about 500,000 Arabs. So it's not like we're talking about a booming movement. I mean, you know, on any given Sunday down at M&T Bank, there's 75,000 people. Think of it that way. All right, so three times as many there as were in the entire land of Israel. In 1896, he becomes editor of Hashiloach. That's Hashiloah. That's a very influential Hebrew weekly, or monthly, I'm sorry. He does that for 6 years. That brings him into connection and exposure with the Hebrew writers of his day. Remember, when you're writing and editing a Hebrew journal, you're writing to a certain group of people. People who are willing to engage in the ideas which you propose, including fighting back. And this was part of the mantra of the day. By 1908, he moved to London. He was the head of the London branch of Wysocki. Anybody ever heard of Wysocki tea?
Yeah.
I love that tea. I have it every Shabbat. You know, a Russian Jewish tea magnate owned it. Didn't know there were Russian Jewish tea magnates, but apparently there was. So he continued to write. by 1922, and by the way, every time first Herzl and then others would do something in the Zionist movement, Ahad HaAm would write a response. He would basically say, no, and this is why. He was he wasn't the enfant terrible, that's bad pronunciation, but he was very rigorous in his criticism. If you read some of his writings, you saw that. 1922, he settles in Tel Aviv, as I mentioned. He becomes a member of the city council, and when he finally dies in 1927, it's a huge funeral, huge outpouring, because what Ahad HaAm did more than anybody else, I hadn't mentioned this yet, is he made Hebrew writing come alive. He twisted and turned phrases. He was a beautiful stylist. He was a real composer of words. And he was the first one who really made it happen. Now, others in this, you know, right after him are going to come. There's a plethora, and we're going to meet some of them tonight. But he was the first guy that put Hebrew writing on the map.
Didn't he work with Chaim Weizmann when he was in England?
Weizmann comes to England in 1904.
Did I read that they overlap? They were
together. They do overlap a little bit, and Ahad HaAm works a little bit with Chaim Weizmann in trying to get the British government to put out a Balfour, what became the Balfour Declaration. They also worked a little bit together because Weizmann was one of the rebels at the 1901 Zionist Convention with the cultural Zionists, even though Ahad HaAm wasn't at that convention. So they certainly knew each other, they did some work together, but Ahad HaAm was shy, he kept to himself, despite the tremendous influence that he had. People, you know, it's not like today, people wouldn't recognize him if he walked down the street.
Did he write all in Hebrew?
He also wrote in Yiddish and Russian, but he primarily wrote in Hebrew. Absolutely primarily wrote in Hebrew, because that was the audience he was trying to impact. His whole thing was about a Hebrew revival, for both the language and the people. All right, any questions? Let's take a break. Thank you. All right, so we've been spending a lot of time talking about cultural Zionism. It's just really funny to see all these candies laying out there.
I thought just wrapped. My husband had thrown them.
Might be. Sorry. I hear they're good. We've been talking about cultural Zionism.
Too much pressure, I can recollect.
And Ahad HaAm. Ahad HaAm, or Asher Ginsberg. He, of course, came to fame from his writings. So we're going to take a look at one of his writings. By the way, someone had said last time when I asked him to read that the point size was too small, so I made it a little bit bigger. I think this was the one we were supposed to read, Truth from Eretz Yisrael, or was that another one?
The wrong way,
Loza Aderech, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is another one, A Truth from Eretz Yisrael. This was Ahad HaAm went to Israel in 1889 for the land of Israel for his first trip. And he went, as I had said, to look up the Chovevei Tzion settlements in the land. This wasn't like today. I went to Israel once for a day and a half for a trip, you know. Travel all day, stay a day and a half, come back the day after that. He was there for 3 months. So when you're in a place for 3 months, you really get to soak in what's going on, and you get to have people whisper in your ear when they know who you are and things like that. And it was always his job to come back and say the things that everybody else didn't want them to say. You know, there's a great modern Hebrew word, some of you may know, it's hasbara. Anybody know that word?
Yeah.
What's it mean?
PR,
yeah, putting a good face on everything. Well, he was the anti-Hasbara guy. He was the guy that would go and say, no, this is really what's going on. This is the truth from Eretz Yisrael. He focused on this and reports from subsequent trips to Israel. He made about 4 or 5 of them there, on how upset many of the settlers were with their lifestyle, particularly the early settlers, how difficult it was, how they were ignoring the Arabs, and how the land was simply unprepared to host the masses of Jews that Herzl and others said it was supposed to host. Even if Herzl said 100,000 were supposed to come, Ahad HaAm said, there's no way that this land, which basically doesn't even have paved road, can be settled in. Remember, there's basically a rickety trail between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. You know, it's not the highway that we're talking about now. The ones, by the way, who really created the road system in Israel were the British. If the British did anything in Palestine, it was setting up an infrastructure because, of course, they thought they were going to be there a while. It turned out to be 30 years, but nonetheless, it wasn't as long as they thought it was going to be. All right, so this is what he said. Can I get a volunteer to read?
I'll read.
Oh.
Oh, honey.
You want to split it?
Yeah.
You all want to do it together?
How is that? Plural reading.
We who live abroad are accustomed to believe that almost all of Eretz Israel is now uninhabited desert, and whoever wishes can buy land there as he pleases. But this is not true. It is very difficult to find in the land cultivated fields that are not used for planting. Only those sand fields or stone mountains that would require the investment of hard labor and great expense to make them good for planting remain uncultivated, and that's because the Arabs do not like working too much in the present for a distant future. Therefore, it is very difficult to find good land for cattle, and not only peasants, but also rich landowners are not selling good land so easily. I guess he didn't meet the Arab who grew the olive tree for his grapes.
Exactly.
We who live abroad are accustomed to believing that the Arabs are all wild desert people who, like donkeys, neither see nor understand what is happening around them. But this is a grave mistake. The Arab, like all the Semites, is sharp-minded and shrewd. All the townships of Syria and Eretz Israel are full of Arab merchants who know how to exploit the masses and keep track of everyone with whom they deal. The same as in Europe. The Arabs, especially the urban elite, see and understand what we are doing and what we wish to do on the land, but they keep quiet and pretend not to notice anything. For now, they do not consider our actions as presenting a future threat to them. But if the time comes that our people's lives in Eretz Israel will develop to a point where we are taking their place, either slightly or significantly, the natives are not going to just step aside so easily.
Okay, so Achad'am is prescient. He talks about something that no one is talking about at this moment. Remember, 2 weeks ago we saw the letter that Herzl sent the Arab sheikh, I think in Jerusalem, when the Arab was concerned about the settlers coming, and, you know, Herzl said, don't worry, we're going to raise your land values. Everything's going to be great. So Achad'am says, everything's not going to be great. In fact, there's basically a battle or a war coming, and you need to be ready for this. Now,
actually, they were both right. The truth is, the Israelis have increased the value of the land.
Absolutely.
And the Arabs are not happy about it.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the point, too. Much of the land is not the Arabs' land that they're talking about, right? The all the land that was in the Jewish state that the Jewish National Fund didn't own in 1948 went to the Israel Lands Authority. There is some private land, but not very much. Not very much at all. Now, how do you think Achad'am went over with Chove Tzion and the political Zionists? I mean, do you think they were happy to hear about this?
No. They wanted it to be the land of milk and honey.
Exactly. They wanted it to be Hasbara land. You know, everything was great. Well, it wasn't great. That doesn't mean that it wasn't a monumental undertaking. What Achad'am's agenda was to slow down this process. He said, you don't need to worry about political Zionism. You don't need to have the Sultan or the Kaiser or somebody else give you permission to settle Jews in the land. You need to slowly keep settling Jews in the land and build up the community, and you need to work in the diaspora to make sure that we are rejuvenating ourselves as well. And when we rejuvenate ourselves in the diaspora, more of us will want to go to the land of Israel. So he basically said, put a brake on it. You know, it's not such a big deal that at that point, 1889, I don't know the exact number, but they probably had 10,000 to 15,000 Jews in the land of Israel. And keep in mind, at least half of those are pious Jews in Jerusalem. Right, they're not the Zionists, the secular Zionists. Even though in this first wave of Olim, or people who made Aliyah, a majority of them still live some type of religious life. Remember, one of the first buildings they always put up was a synagogue.
And yeah. How many Arabs were there at the time?
There were 500,000 by 1900. I don't know how many there were in 1889, but I can't imagine it was much different, if any, if at all. Because, you know, maybe there were 480,000, something like that. All right, one of the other things Achad'am did that he's known for is he started being disenchanted with Chovei Tzion in general. They weren't listening enough to him. So he started a small group called B'nai Moshe, B'NAI and then M-O-S-H-E. This was an elite group within Chovei Tzion, and he really picked the best and the brightest to get things done that he believed needed to get done. Now, what does B'nai Moshe mean?
Sons of Moses.
Sons or children of Moses. And why was it Moses? Why do you think he chose Moses? He led the people out of slavery. And what was his ultimate fate?
For 40 years.
And what was his ultimate fate?
Never got there.
He never got there. It was going to be a long haul. That's right. Everything is particularly chosen for specific reasons. B'nai Moshe. So these were the goals of B'nai Moshe. Improve Hebrew education, build an audience for Hebrew literature, and support the settlers. He wasn't giving up on the settlers by any stretch of the imagination. They did a lot for a small group. Eventually, by the way, after cultural and political Zionism came, Herzl, by 1901, they merged back into the ZOA, the ZO, I'm sorry, the Zionist organization. In 1890, they founded a small settlement called Rehovot. Anybody been there?
Yeah.
It's not so small anymore, but it was started by these guys. They started a Hebrew publishing company. You don't have to worry about the name, but it's Achi Asaf. They wanted more Hebrew writings to become published and popularized in Eastern Europe. They started the first Hebrew school in Russia. You know, Hebrew schools back then weren't what Hebrew schools are now. Hebrew schools now are religious. Then, they were meant to teach Hebrew. Just like going to Cheder was meant to teach Talmud. They created several Hebrew libraries in Palestine, which was pretty significant. Remember, you're living in a world where there are no Hebrew libraries. They created secular Hebrew language day schools in Russia. Not too many, a handful, but nonetheless, it was impressive. I'm sorry, they lasted until 1899. I said 1901. So it's called the B'nai Moshe. There's a great book, by the way, that I have at home somewhere about Echad HaAm by a guy named Leon Simon, S-I-M-O-N. Simon was younger than Echad HaAm, but met him when he was in England and basically became his publicist for the last decade and a half of Echad HaAm's life. And in 1950, he wrote a memory or biography of Echad HaAm. It's a wonderful book. Echad HaAm did something else important. He hailed the start of the modern Hebrew movement. We're going to get to him in that mythical few weeks, but Eliezer Ben Yehuda at this point is starting to put out his Hebrew dictionary and what's really a Hebrew encyclopedia in Jerusalem. Remember, this is a time when many Zionists still favor German, as we saw from Herzl, for the Zionist movement. Right? It was not a guarantee until about 1915, with the battle over the language for the Technion in Haifa, that Hebrew would be the main language of the Yishuv. And eventually, you know, one would say the second language of every Jew outside of the land of Israel. Israelis, by the way, think it's hysterical that so many of us can read Hebrew but have no idea what we're reading, which is kind of interesting. If you ever want to blow your mind, read the translation to the prayers and see if you believe it. But that's another comment. All right. Trying to see what we didn't cover. He was the constant critic from the outside. As I said, he responded to every initiative with an article. And in fact, his followers anticipated his articles. Chaim Weizmann, in his memoirs, says that we all basically waited with bated breath for Echad HaAm to put out his article, and we would devour it and go through it and debate it. He began, as I said, believing Chovei Tzion was a failure, and eventually he dropped out of Chovei Tzion. He was no longer active. He wouldn't participate in their events. He saw his main job as first being head of the London office of Wysotsky and then being the Zionist critic. One of the things that he criticized a great deal in his writings was he said that we say that we're trying to create these great new independent communities the first time since the Roman era, but they're dependent on European money. If European money disappeared, the settlements would disappear. These are not farms that are self-serving. I believe I mentioned when we were talking about Baron Rothschild, he had to buy the wine, which wasn't that good. It wasn't a good vintage, which was the only way that those settlements would survive. So Echad HaAm, you know, really take the rose-colored glasses off. This is going to be a lot harder than we think it's going to be. Let me tell you a little bit more in general about cultural Zionists. I did a little bit in the first half, but I'm going to give you a couple other attributes because they're so interesting. We had said that anti-Semitism was not the major issue for them. Assimilation was. Right? How do we keep Jews within the Jewish people? They believed in a leadership based on intellect, uncompromising integrity, and honesty, above all. For them and for Echad HaAm, ethics was central to their concerns. Absolutely central to their concerns. And he quotes, interestingly enough, cites from the text, from the ancient sources, the Jewish sources, as to why ethics are so important. And this is, you know, a secularization, again, of the religion. They believed that the history of the Jews is one that absorbs the best of other cultures. Judaism does not stand on its own. Judaism is a part of the world. Remember, this is a guy and people who are reading literature from the rest of the world, or the other communities at least. I'll give you a quick example. The Passover Seder. When did that start? Right? There's a thing in the Talmud that says four sages stayed up all night and talked, debated the Seder. But really, it was in the early Middle Ages that the banquet that we do today, essentially as a banquet, came into being, and that plucks from the ancient Greek traditions of having a banquet and debating. So, any other examples anyone has?
I thought the Last Supper was supposed to be the Seder night.
That was on a Seder night too, but that was a little different. That was different. You know, my understanding is it came from the early Middle Ages, but
so are you saying?
Come to think about it, you're right. From what I understand,
so would you say that perhaps the difference was that the biblical time period or the temple, the Last Supper was at the time of the temple, was probably more about the sacrifices and didn't have a Haggadah, whereas the middle.
I don't want to speculate because I don't know that area real well, so it's possible. I'm going to have to look that up. I'm gonna have to look. I seem to remember the early Middle Ages, but you could be right. So, anyone else know about that?
The Last Supper was supposedly
a Seder.
The Seder could have been a different kind. I don't know.
Right, a Seder just means order.
Seder,
right.
And yeah. We don't type
a Seder.
Right. Maybe what you're thinking of.
The dipping.
The
and, right.
What, we've all, you know,
certainly, the Haggadot were written among the ones that they find out are supposedly so old, or 1400, 1500,
right.
1600, which would be the Middle Ages.
Right. So, right. I'll have to look it up. All right. Obviously, the land of Israel is the focal point for Jewish life. This is important because that wasn't the case for everybody. We're going to get to the Uganda crisis in a few moments. But remember that Herzl and others originally said, well, Argentina is a pretty good-looking place, too. And indeed, there were Jewish colonists that Baron Hirsch sent to Argentina. A couple thousand, not that many, but nonetheless, that was a possibility for resettlement for the Jews of Eastern Europe as well. The Yishuv, as I had mentioned, was going to be the spiritual center. The spiritual center, that's where all innovation from Judaism was going to come from. For Echad HaAm and his followers, there was no innovation from Judaism. They didn't believe in the Western stuff of Reform and Conservative Judaism, or even Modern Orthodoxy. That just didn't work for them. They needed something new, something radically new. They, of course, directly confronted Herzl. You know, Herzl was the god of the Zionist movement, but not for these guys. Right? For many others, he was. They said, ultimately, they didn't just want a state for the Jews. What did they want? A Jewish state. They wanted to be Jewish in their way, not religious, but they wanted to be Jewish. They wanted a state of Hebrew culture. All right, let's take a look at Echad HaAm's second trip.
I don't
was anybody really thinking in those terms of a state? I mean, I think they were talking about a Jewish kind of civilization or a way to live and be Jewish, an anti-assimilationist view, and this is going to be the model.
Ultimately, they said it
really
would,
a state.
Ultimately, they said it would be a state, but it was going to take generations to get there. But at first, it was going to be the center of Jewish culture, and it was going to emanate out to the diaspora, but ultimately there would be a Jewish state, but that wouldn't be until there was a majority of Jews in the land of Israel. Since there were 500,000 Arabs and 25,000 Jews in 1900, it was going to take a while. That was the ultimate goal. Nobody doubted that. But the fact of the matter is, Ahad Am and his followers said, it's not going to happen in our lifetime, so let's not talk about that now. But in their writings, that's what they say, though. That is their ultimate goal.
Are you saying, then, a state in the sense that Herzl meant a state? Or
no.
Or taking a step further and talking about an actual Jewish nation? I didn't see that.
An actual Jewish nation?
What
do you mean by...
You mean Jewish nation or Jewish country?
A Jewish state.
There will be
a political
entity.
Ultimately, there will be
that
political entity, but it won't be for quite some time. So, absolutely.
It sounds like he really was setting the cornerstone for that eventuality with wanting it to be Hebrew language spoken in his writings, and you touched on that he wanted currency for them to be able to have their own money, to make their own money.
Right, and keep in mind, we know from our friend Hobsbawm that language was a key element of nationalism.
Right.
And he was impacted, I should say, by that era as well. Here's, by the way, what he said about Herzl's political Zionism, if you haven't read it. Herzl's pursuit of great men, princes, and rulers who were to give us Palestine was the pursuit of a mirage. We, on the other hand, had little faith in the benevolence of the mighty. So he wasn't so keen on Herzl. All right, let's take a look.
Oh, there, you got it right there.
Yeah, here, so... why does it keep doing that to me? The Jewish State and the Jewish Problem was an essay that Ahad Am wrote, as I think I might have mentioned, right after the first Zionist Congress, in which he said that he felt that he was a mourner at a wedding feast. If a Jewish state were reestablished, a state arranged and organized exactly after the pattern of other states, then the Western Jews could live a full, complete life among his own people and find at home all that he now sees outside, Altenua Land, dangled before his eyes but out of reach. Altenua Land wasn't written until 1902. Of course, not all the Jews will be able to take wing and go to their state, but the very existence of the Jewish state will raise the prestige of those who remain in exile, and their fellow citizens will no more despise them and keep them at arm's length as though they were ignoble slaves dependent entirely on the hospitality of others. Ultimately, when there's a Jewish state, Ahad Am is saying, we're going to do away with anti-Semitism because Jews will have a certain sense of pride and begin to act differently, and they'll have their own language, just like there are multiple languages in various countries now. And again, I keep going back to Hobsbawm, which I'm really surprised about. But I think he had said in there it was until the early 1950s that the majority of the Italians didn't speak Italian as their first language. It was only when TVs came that they were able to spread that language. It was not uncommon in this era for people, certainly in Russia, to have different languages. You have different people, the Tartars and, what have you, the Chechens, as we know of today, and the Armenians are in there as well. I'm going to see if I have one of the... All right, I'm going to read one of the quotes because I didn't put it up here, unfortunately. Let's do another one, Ahad Am from the Jewish State and the Jewish Problem. His essays, as you saw from the book, are relatively long, and you have to sit and focus on them. Can I get a volunteer to read this?
This Jewish settlement, which will be a gradual growth, will become, in course of time, the center of the nation, wherein its spirit will find pure expression and develop in all its aspects up to the highest degree of perfection of which it is capable. Then, from the center, the spirit of Judaism will go forth to the great circumference, to all the communities of the diaspora, and will breathe new life into them and preserve their unity. And when our national culture in Palestine has attained that level, we may be confident that it will produce men in the country who will be able, on a favorable opportunity, to establish a state which will be truly a Jewish state and not merely a state of Jews.
So this is my favorite passage from Echad Ha'am, because I think he got it. I think ostensibly this is what happened. Now you can argue as to whether or not the state of Israel today is a Jewish state, and I'll argue that it is, and just because it's a Jewish state doesn't mean it's not going to have problems. I don't know about you guys, but I know a few Jewish families that actually have problems. So, not speaking of my own at all. But he really hit it. Israel today is the centerpiece of Jewish life. Right? Michelle, you teach Hebrew school, right?
Correct.
So how Israel impacted is the Hebrew school?
Well, we're studying, well, Jews around the world, plus Israel is always a focus.
The and songs you sing.
Songs we sing. Plus we're doing the history, and the history, of course, is focused on Israel and the Jews from it. You know,
right.
So the Jewish history based on what happened in that area, that region.
Aaron?
What was his timeline for gradual growth, though?
Several generations, if maybe 100 years.
I mean, it seems to me that he was off on that
Yeah, he was off on that one. But you can...
And if we would have stuck to that, none of this would have happened.
History's a funny thing, right? First you have the British, and then you have the Holocaust, and, you know, and so on and so on. But it took a generation or two.
I still get amazed from the course, because I knew so little to begin with, that, like, that's why I keep going about 25,000 Jews in 1900.
It's nothing.
Yeah, right. It's just amazing. And I think the bull rush effect of having, you know, so many come in such quick time, you know, we were able to catch the world off guard in a certain respect and establish something, you know, incredible. And that if it would have been more deliberate, there probably would have been many times when we wouldn't have been able to, you know, pull this off.
Well, you know, 25,000 then, in 1948, when independence was declared on May 15th, there was only 650,000 Jews. It's nothing. It's nothing. This is, Metro Baltimore has more than that. Yeah, Michelle? Jill. Whatever your name is. You and the scarf thing.
I mean, I think the whole mid-century and the diaspora after the Holocaust and the state was established, that people were rallying around the state, and the diaspora really felt like, well, now we have the state, so now we'll be safe. And the way the next generation is now, they don't have that. A lot of them don't. Young people don't have that connection that
right.
we grew up with, that the generation before, my mother-in-law's generation, and it's very different. You can't make the same arguments the same way that remains to us growing up. So, but I think that essentially is how most of us grew up. That
right.
this was, you know, it's a miracle that Israel is there, and we're so happy, and we felt safer, and then everyone kind of breathed a sigh of relief and assimilated.
Well, two quick things, and this will be for next year's course to delve into at great length. But, you know, many of us remember a time when Israel was truly threatened, right? And the younger generation, fortunately, doesn't remember that. And we live in a greater society that celebrates individualism and not collectivism. I'm not talking about socialism or communism. I'm just talking about what an Israeli sociologist named Amitai Etzioni would call communitarianism. And that's unfortunate. So it was, again, a different era. Yeah, Michelle, you're the real Michelle.
Yes. That I was going to say is, like, every time I start thinking that, like, the next generation or the kids who are coming through high school don't feel the same way we do, I tried to do a debate with my 12th graders on what's happening at Swarthmore, and they just looked at me like, what, are these people crazy? Because they're looking at it as the Swarthmore kids made the point of our generation grew up with a powerful Israel, not one that's being threatened. And my students are going, what are they crazy? Israel's always threatened. And it's very interesting to see. Every time I think I know, it's the individual thing. They're all thinking something different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't feel threats.
Right.
No,
they don't know threats.
I mean, the younger, our children in America did not grow up with almost any conspicuous anti-Semitism.
Right. Right, absolutely.
Depends on where you lived.
Yeah, if you grew up in the South, it was a different thing.
I'm talking about, no, from I grew up with it, you grew up with it, and we grew up in the same town. But I'm talking about, you know, post, you know, 20 years and younger.
It's a different time and place, and it's fascinating, you know, as I research this stuff, and I say to myself, could this ever happen again?
Absolutely.
You know? I don't know, because of the individualism.
Or
I don't know.
Ever happened,
yeah. Could there be a creation of the State of Israel? You know, or for another people, could that happen again?
Kurdistan.
You know, a quick note on Kurdistan. You know, the Kurds are in four countries, right? They're in Russia. I thought it was 40 million.
40 million.
Yeah, they're Russia, Iraq, Syria, and I guess Lebanon, right?
Turkey.
Are they in Iran also?
Yes.
I didn't know. Okay.
Turkey, Syria.
They can't do what the Jews did, right? It's just they're not able to do it, and there are 40 to 50 million of them. Anybody know how many Jews are in the world today?
14.
About 14 million. Depends on what survey you want to look at.
But part of it had to do with Israel is you had an influx of people from the camps of the survivors who had a tradition of democratic government.
You had leadership in the
right. But the state had already been established by then, remember. You know, they didn't come till really after 48. The DP camps opened in 47 and 48.
But the part of their democratic orientation in Palestine had to do with the Brits.
Absolutely.
But you didn't go to densely populated land.
Right, it's a different...
And it was in pretty crappy condition.
Yeah. Kurdistan, of Kurdistan is pretty crappy condition.
But they're there, it's settled.
Right, they're already there. Right. You're right. You're
and
right.
The Jews came from lands that didn't want them anymore, whereas the Kurds are trying to carve out a country from four countries or five countries who aren't about to let them go.
Yeah. And
right.
Keep the oil.
Yeah, Kirkuk.
And yeah. Another thing they
Hang on a second, yeah?
They don't have the Rosh Gadol.
Right. Well, I don't want to get into ethnocentrism. You know, every people has their leaders, and there's just different times and different eras. So, okay, you know.
And we have
in the world of real estate, it's a lot easier to get a piece of land and develop it, from the ground rather than go into an urban area and have to deal with 10 different buildings and then redevelop something.
That makes sense.
I think it's a little simple.
That makes sense. All right, let me get back to Echada Am here. A lot of good diversity tonight. It's very interesting. Pressure from his pen, really, because that's the pressure that he wielded, the power that he wielded, in 1898 forced the Zionist Congress to agree to disseminate Zionist information throughout the diaspora. They weren't doing any education at first. That wasn't part of Herzl's agenda. Herzl wanted to go and meet the Kaiser and the Sultan and the foreign minister of Russia, Pleve and some others. That's what he thought was important. Echada Am said, no, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than you, Mr. Herzl. Because remember, Herzl didn't have a necessarily small ego, if you recall. Right? He literally thought he was king of the Jews. And some could argue that he was king of the Jews, at least in the sphere in which he was active. all right, I don't have this on here, so I'm going to read. This is very interesting. What Echada Am said the state would mean for Eastern Jews, Eastern European Jews, and for Western/Central. When I say Western, I mean Central also, European Jews. Said there would be two different things. And this is, again, from my favorite essay, The Jewish State and the Jewish Problem. For those in the West, he said, if a Jewish state were established, a state arranged and organized exactly after the pattern of other states... Oh, we read this. Mm-hmm. Never mind. I apologize. It was. I told you it was out of order. All right. Let me... A couple final moments on Echada Am. Your hand raised, Mitch?
Yeah. Actually, I read the wrong way.
Loza Adera. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I read it.
I made some notes.
Sure.
Thank you. I just didn't want this to go to waste.
Do you remember the history behind this essay?
No.
Okay, this was the first essay that he wrote, and we quote a little bit from it earlier, I think, in 1889 after his first trip to the land of Israel to check the Hovetzion settlements. He said, this is the wrong way.
We're not getting it done the right way.
Right, right.
So he was Jewish colonization of Palestine was in its infant stage. He asked the question, why are Jews different from any other race or nation? And are we a people only bound by religion?
Mm-hmm.
He bemoans the slow progress in Palestine, and then he discusses collectivism versus the individual. He says that Jews started out as collectivism, and he cited back into the, you know, look at what happened with the Romans. I think mm-hmm. Adrian and Titus, he mentioned that, you know, how we stuck together as a nation. Then we moved toward individualism, which is basically yourself, your family, and your congregation. And now he wants Jews to think in the collective regarding the colonization of Palestine. However, many Jews went to Palestine for personal ambitions, but not to develop the country for future generations. He's an advocate of a revival of men with deeper attachment to the national life, so that instead of adding more ruins, and these are failed settlements, endeavor to give strong roots by force, not by force, but by spirit. And after that, maybe the work of national development can get done.
All right, and one of the things that he talked about, thank you, that he talked about as well, is the fact that the people that we're sending there aren't prepared. These guys aren't ready. They're not cutting it. There's no training. That's why he focused on building up the diaspora first. And from that, we're going to find our best and our brightest and most prepared, and we're going to send them to the land of Israel, and they're going to build that center of spiritual culture that's going to impact the rest of the Jewish world. They're both good essays. I just like the Jewish state and the Jewish problem one the most.
His thinking feels very contemporary. If we're in mm-hmm. business and thinking about how to solve a problem, this is the way we would go about it. I mean,
absolutely, if you have the time.
Well, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Throw all these resources at something that's going to fail because you haven't planned to prepare
right.
properly? I mean, it's the way we
healthcare.gov.
But I don't think they ever thought of it, would it or would it not succeed. I think they figured that if they went, it would succeed.
But that was a naivete, not born of knowing how harsh the conditions were.
Right,
and what
right.
would be required, even physically.
True. And so many immigrants
and
came
the health
and
issues
left.
And all those Eastern Europeans who did go with all of that youth and vitality and enthusiasm mm-hmm. and who were the muscle men couldn't hack it. They were being killed by malaria. It wasn't their fault.
Right, and by the 1920s, you should know, there were some farms in Russia. Not in Russia, in surrounding
preparing
countries,
people.
Preparing people that were ostensibly like kibbutzim. Not too many, but they helped prepare some of the immigrants. Because in the 1920s, in the early 20s, the immigration gates opened up because of the British. It got a little dicey after that. We'll get to all that. We'll get to all that. All right. Any questions? Good. Okay. As I said, Echad HaAm was not involved in the political work of the Zionist organization. He was somewhat appalled by it, but he had many followers who were. And under his influence in 1901, they didn't break away, but they formed a faction called the Fraction within the Zionist movement. And this was the beginning of the official splitting of the Zionist movement into camps. By 1902, the next year, we're going to see Mizrahi, which is the religious, modern Orthodox religious Zionists, come into being. It was a reformation of something from about 8 years earlier. About 37 people showed up for this first meeting. They were mainly young Russian-speaking Jews from Russian lands. They really had little power, but they did get an important resolution passed in 1901. It said, the education of the Jewish people in a national spirit is an essential part of the Zionist program. Doesn't sound like necessarily much, but again, they were forcing the agenda to talk about Jewish culture. Chaim Weizmann, a young Chaim Weizmann, well, he's about 30 by that point, was one of their leaders. He would eventually turn into a practical Zionist and then a synthetic Zionist. Stay tuned till next week if it doesn't snow. They focused on building settlements, but eventually they merged into practical Zionism. So just to let you know that Echad HaAm's folks had some official representation and began the fractures within the movement itself. That brings us to the Uganda affair. Did anybody read about or know about the Uganda affair of 1903? Okay. Well, I assure you, yeah?
No, I was going to say, is that when they proposed going to Uganda?
Yeah, it was actually, wasn't necessarily, actually Uganda, it was Kenya.
Kenya.
Yeah, it was actually East Kenya. we would look a little different or think a little differently if we were making our pilgrimages to the state of the Jewish people in Kenya, right? Although apparently there's some nice places there, nice safaris and all that. 1903, an offer was made by the British colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, to the Zionist movement through Theodore Herzl. He met with Herzl, as he did periodically, because remember, Herzl ran around all over the place, so that's what he did. And he said, Dr. Herzl, I was just in Uganda, Kenya, and I said to myself, this is a land for Dr. Herzl. This is a land for the Jewish people. Now, why did he want that to be a Jewish homeland? Any thoughts?
Because English self-interest.
Which were? You're correct.
Well, colonization, he wanted they were just taking over South Africa. They wanted another...
And the Germans were in East Africa also.
Different countries are in different parts of Africa, right, but certainly in the South.
Competition as to who would settle where.
Right, but clearly they wanted colonists, settlers. You know, today settlers has a different connotation in the Jewish world. They wanted settlers to be there, to be their vanguard, to hold on to the land for the British people. And Herzl was intrigued. Now, Herzl said it was fine. Remember, originally, if it's in Palestine, it's fine if it's in Argentina. He said, you know, yeah, we want ultimately to be in Palestine, but things are so bad in Eastern Europe. This is right after the 1903 Kishinev pogroms. We mentioned that in one of the classes. I think about 43 people were killed in the Kishinev pogroms. That's not a tragedy by modern standards, but it was a huge amount of people in that time, and it really terrorized not only those Jewish communities, but all the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe. The pogroms were back. The pogroms were back. And really, for Herzl, a big motivating factor was he needed to save the Jews of Eastern Europe. And he could only do that by creating a Jewish land for them. So Herzl said, I'll take this to the Zionist movement. So he takes this to the Zionist movement in 1903, the Zionist convention, and all heck breaks loose. Well, cursing the synagogue, I wouldn't want to say hell or anything like that. All heck breaks loose. You have the Russian Zionists storm out. They go into another room. They start writing up resolutions condemning Herzl. Herzl goes in to meet with them. They give him the cold shoulder. Other people are chanting. They're singing. They're standing on their chairs. It's kind of bedlam. Finally, a compromise comes up. Exactly. A compromise comes up. What Herzl says is, we're going to recommend that we send a delegation to look at this land. That's all we want to do, to see if it's, you know, suitable for habitation by European Jews. Max Nordau, his friend and sidekick and very famous person of the day, says, think of this as a Nachtstall, a night stop for the Jewish people. It's, you know, a phrase that he comes up with. So, ultimately, Herzl saying he wants it to be a temporary refuge. People are violently opposed, as I said. Herzl comes forward to the podium and he declares in Hebrew, Eshchachecha Yerushalayim, Eshchachechet Yemini, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning. Right? He's vowing his loyalty. What he's really saying is, I haven't given up on the ultimate goal, but we need to send people to investigate this for another important reason. The British just made us an offer for a homeland. This is what we've been trying to do all along. At a minimum, we need to seriously consider this offer. You know, he's so pent up on success that he says that he's willing to sacrifice Palestine in the short term. The motion to consider the plan passes 295 to 178. It's not massive, right? But it's solid enough. Well, here's my favorite description. In 1904, the investigatory delegation went. They found a dangerous land filled with lions and other creatures. And it was populated by locals who weren't so keen on European settlement. Okay, so now, what also happens, unfortunately, in 1904? Anyone remember? Herzl dies. Right, Herzl dies in 1904, so this whole thing really dies with him. They report back in 1905 to the Zionist Congress that no thank you, and to the British, no thank you. But nonetheless, this is the first time in Jewish history, certainly modern Jewish history, that a Jewish homeland is proposed by a non-Jewish power. Right? There was actually an attempt at doing that. Now, this might stun you. Let me just check the time. 5 more minutes. This might stun you. It actually created a schism to reject it. Right? So a group did what good Jewish groups do, broke off from the Zionist organization at this time. It was called the Jewish Territorialist Organization. The Jewish Territorialist Organization, led by Israel Zangwill, a well-known British author and Zionist activist, basically said it doesn't matter where there's a Jewish homeland. There needs to be a Jewish homeland. Right? These are the people, by the way, that at one point bring 9,000 Jews into the United States through Galveston, Texas. And there are small towns in Texas that have Jewish heritage because of this. That was through the Jewish Territorialist Organization. Nahum Sirkin, who I was talking about earlier, was another one of their leaders. This movement always gained in popularity when there were pogroms. And it dropped in popularity when there were things such as the Balfour Declaration in November 1917. They investigated portions of Canada, Australia, and similar places, Argentina, they had already looked at. But wherever they went, they found opposition from local residents. Right? And of course, the Zionists were going to find opposition from local residents in Palestine as well. So finally, everybody was starting to come around to Ahad HaAm's notion that this isn't going to be as easy as we think. Right? You know, again, I go back to Herzl's Alte Neuland. It's just, you know, a glorious, you know, trip through fantasy. Yeah?
Did Ahad HaAm consider anything but Israel?
Ahad HaAm never considered anything but Israel. It couldn't be anywhere but Israel, because that was the root of Hebrew culture. It had to be from Israel. It wouldn't make sense to him anywhere else. You know, you think about his background. You have your hand up or just...
No.
Okay. All right. I think what I'm going to do... Oh, final note. So what did Ahad HaAm really want to happen? We've touched on some of it. I'm just going to review it real quickly. He believed the answer wasn't establishing a Jewish state immediately, which went against the whole ethos of the Zionist movement, but gradual immigration to create that cultural center that we talked about. He said the main goal, this is different too, the main goal of Zionism is not to create a Jewish state, it's to reinvigorate the diaspora. That's the main goal of Zionism, to impact the diaspora, because the vast majority of Jews are always, not always, but for the next 100 years or so, are going to be in the diaspora. And we're going to lose them to assimilation if we don't find something for them to hang on to. That's it. Maybe next week we'll go into some of these cultural rebels that I talked about, Michael Berdichevsky, but next week we're really going to dig into Chaim Weizmann. We're going to do the Balfour Declaration, and we're going to do the Zionist movement in World War I. So we're both moving chronologically as well as thematically, cultural Zionism and political Zionism and what have you. By the way, I'm always open to suggestions as to other topics that you want to make sure we cover, or if you want me to do it differently, anything like that. I'm happy to talk to anyone about that. So, as always, thank you for your patience.
2 weeks,
January 7th. Oh, 2 weeks, okay.
January 7th.
The other team has their holiday.
That's right.